Well, good evening, and let me just say, I'm impressed. In Oklahoma, we would call you bitter enders, because you stay to the bitter end and stay engaged in a long evening and a lot of conversation. But let me not just say I'm impressed at this, but from an Oklahoman coming here, we had a conversation in Oklahoma about presidential elections, and we kept saying, we know where we are. It is up to some of these other states to be able to drive what happens in the next presidential election. So from an Oklahoman traveling here, thank you for your engagement and for the way that you turn around the nation. We did our part, but you certainly did yours. For Governor, thank you for being here and for speaking out and leading so effectively well. For Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley and Steve King, who I get the opportunity to be able to serve with, it's great to be able to see y'all. So many other folks that are here. Steve, for your incredible leadership, to be able to pull an event like this together is truly impressive to be able to do this. But let me give you just a quick snapshot of a couple of things that are there, just so you can get on the other side of it. There's a group of us that have kind of a running conversation about the birthday boy, Chuck Grassley. He is quietly known as the number one curmudgeon of the Senate. And there's another one that's right behind him that he affectionately calls himself the number two curmudgeon. It's Pat Roberts from Kansas. He always says he aspires to be the Chuck Grassley. Chuck Grassley is an amazing voice for you and has done a remarkable job. And I know he's not a lawyer, but he somehow survived anyway leading the nation. And he's done a really, truly effective job. And we've said over and over again about Gorsuch, but it's not just Gorsuch. We've got about 135 other judges that are federal judges that will be appointed around the country over the next couple of months. Those individuals will transform the judiciary. So I have deep, overwhelming appreciation for what Chuck is doing. And for Joni Ernst and I, and she and I, I'm going to out her in this, but she and I have a Bible study with about eight of us that we started with, mostly those that have been there a couple of years in the Senate, that we started meeting on Tuesday mornings for an early breakfast, usually after she's had a rucksack march of 4 miles or something after that. But it's great to get to know her and her family and Gail and who they are in the consistency of their message. They're representing you extremely well in the United States Senate, and you should be incredibly proud, and I'm hearing tonight that you are exceptionally proud of them for good reason on that. As has already been mentioned, the Constitution turns 230 years old this week. You realize it's the oldest Constitution in the world. But the buzz among some is, government's not working anymore. Things are all locked up. And the hidden message right behind it is, maybe this representative republic idea is an old idea for some old guys 2 centuries ago, and we need to do a different form of government. May I say to you, the problem with the Constitution is not the Constitution, it's that we're not practicing the Constitution any longer. That's the issue. We became the most powerful nation in the world, not in spite of our Constitution, but because of this basic principle of we the people. We're not about a monarchy. We're not about a super elite group. We're not about this group gets to lead and everyone else gets to follow. It is truly us. And let me give you an example. We've not met before, you and I, most of us. You see me as U.S. Senator. My wife, who is with me here, is Cindy right there. Of course, every day she addresses me as U.S. Senator Lankford. Every day. But if you talk to Cindy and I, we're just us. And people see us as senators, and they don't understand. I'm an Oklahoman. I spent 22 years in full-time ministry. I'm a Southern Baptist pastor. In fact, it's worse than that for you pastors that are here. I'm a youth pastor. And for every time I speak to a pastor's group, I always tell them the most amazing thing is not that a minister is involved in Congress. It's that pastors actually meet with an old youth pastor and they listen. It's For 22 years, I worked with middle school, high school, and college-age students. I had the privilege of directing the Falls Creek Youth Camp, which is in southern Oklahoma. It's the largest Christian camp in America. We have 51,000 students a summer that come to Falls Creek. It's a very unique place where we literally see thousands of students come to Christ every summer, and we see students come from all over the state and, quite frankly, from all over the nation, that they come because they deal with their social life, they deal with their physical life, they deal with their mental life, but they suddenly figure out, I have never determined what I'm going to do with my spiritual life. And they come and spend a week away from everything and just try to figure out, is there a God and can I know him? It's a remarkable place to serve. And for Cindy and I, it was our joy to be able to lead there for 15 years. We assumed we were always going to be there. And in 2008 and 2009, God completely interrupted our life. I would tell you, in 2009, when I announced that I was going to run for the United States Congress, no one said, I saw that one coming. No one said, you know what? You know what? If you're going to get to the Senate, you really should be a youth pastor first. No one said, gosh, if you go direct this youth camp out in the woods, you'll figure this out. Though I would tell you, it was very good preparation. Learning how to deal with thousands of juveniles did prepare me better than you would think. This was not something anyone saw coming. I'm just one of us. But God called us to this task. We ran an election and won an election, represent the great state of Oklahoma and some tremendous people that are there. In fact, it was fun for Cindy and I when we were walking around visiting with folks back and getting a round of fried chicken, which was really good. When we were coming back around and somebody caught us and said, are you having a good time? I said, I feel like I'm at home. Y'all have been so kind and so gracious. I don't know why y'all are considered such a hate group. Y'all seem so nice. Doing ministry and working with people and experiencing God's call to be able to step out and do this was this great interruption for us. But for Cindy and I, we really sense this is the exact same calling we've always had. Now again, not everyone comes from a biblical worldview, and I get that, and I respect that. We are a nation that protects people of faith to be able to live out their faith, or to protect people who have no faith to be able to not practice a faith. That is protected in our nation. And I never want us to be in a situation where we compel people to have a certain faith or to have faith at all. Quite frankly, I believe that when you come to Christ, it's a choice that you make to be able to follow after him. But for Cindy and I, we feel like we're still doing ministry. The calling that I had years ago was, come, follow me. That was an attachment to a person, not to an occupation. That was to say, where he leads, we go. And we've sensed this is where we're supposed to be. And we sense a unique responsibility to not only follow him, but to do what he has called us to do to the best of our possible ability. The worst case scenario for me has always been not going to an election and losing. It was being elected and not being affected or dishonoring my Lord in the process. That's the target for us. I tell you that story only because I want you to understand. Our Constitution's still working and our system is still working. Just normal, ordinary people who have never been involved in elected office are still being elected. People are stepping up and saying, this is what I feel called to do, and actually stepping in and engaging it. It's not a select group. It's us. If we choose to be able to step into this. After World War II, our nation was incredibly hopeful about the future. We had just been through a horrible war, and our ingenuity and our creativity and our hard work ethic, and just coming out of beating Italy and Germany and beating back the Japanese Empire, conquering who they thought could not be stopped, gave us this sense that we could do anything. And we did. But of late, people think we can do anything, but we're not. And people are losing hope again. Now, I know that was the buzz phrase for President Obama, but this picture of, if we could only allow the government to do more, people would have more hope, I think a nation awakened and realized that's not where hope comes from. Hope doesn't come from giving it to them and saying they will come fix it. I don't know if you've heard, my state of Oklahoma has quite a reputation for these things called tornadoes. Maybe you've heard of them. Y'all have experienced them just like we have. But it was interesting to me, one of the last tornadoes that came through Oklahoma, I was visiting with some of the Red Cross volunteers that had come in from out of state. Red Cross is good about when they bring in lead people, they're from someplace else to be able to come in because the people that are there, obviously, have got to clean up their own home. So I was visiting with one of the Red Cross volunteers and telling them, thank you for coming into the state to be able to help us out. And I said, how are things going? And their answer was, frustrating. I said, well, tell me about it. They said, well, when we go into many places, and I'll leave the places out they named, by the way, it wasn't Iowa. Said, when we go to many places and we get there, people are sitting on the curb and they say first when we pull up, I'm glad you're finally here, we can get to work. And we bring them gloves and coffee and water and we bring them basic supplies and they get to work. He said, in Oklahoma, when we drive up place and say, hey, we've got food and coffee and gloves and trash bags and everything, they say, oh, we're good. People from our church are already here. Thanks for stopping by. Because there is this sense that you either sit and wait because I have a problem and somebody else is going to come solve it for me, or we get up and do it ourselves. We as conservatives are not trying to wait on somebody else from far away to come solve our problems. We have that responsibility. That's not unique to our time. Let me walk you backwards a couple of thousand years. Can I do that? Let me keep the same hat I've always worn and be a minister hat. I want to read you a passage from the book of Nehemiah. Governor, I just mentioned to the governor earlier that I just came back from Israel. I was chatting with a Jewish friend when I was there in Israel, and we were talking back and forth on a passage, and he kept calling the passage Nehemiah. And I finally had to stare at him and go, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he said, Nehemiah, right after Ezra. I was like, Nehemiah? And he said, what is that? I said, clearly how we pronounce it in Oklahoma is the correct Hebrew pronunciation of it. So let me read this from you from Nehemiah, from Nehemiah. Many of you know the story on it, and if you go to church at all, you probably go through the book of Nehemiah every time you have a church building program. But let me give you a little more context on it. This is 150 years after the people had, after Jerusalem had fallen. All of those individuals had gone into Babylonian captivity, and is true in that area, the Assyrians beat up Israel, and then the Babylonians beat up the Assyrians. The Babylonians beat up Jerusalem and all that area, took them into captivity, and then the Medes and the Persians beat up the Babylonians. So now it's 150 years after the fall of Jerusalem. The Babylonians are long gone, the Medes and the Persians are ruling, but they still have the slave families left over from the Babylonian time period. In all likelihood, Nehemiah had never even been to Jerusalem. He's a slave cupbearer close to the king, and people say he was a trusted advisor. He was an expendable slave cupbearer that was to taste the king's food before the king ate it, and if he dies, they go get another one. That's not a trusted advisor. That's an expendable slave. He had no governing experience. He had no engineering experience. He had nothing else. He had grown up in captivity under the Medes and the Persians. His brother, probably on a slave carrying, as a slave carrying military supplies for the Medes and the Persians, had got to go to Jerusalem, where their father's 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 father had died in captivity. And then he comes back. And Nehemiah catches him, and this is the very beginning of the book. It says, Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men and questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived exile. And I asked them about Jerusalem. So he has two questions. Tell me about the people. Tell me about the city, the place. How's it going? What's it like there? He said to me, those who survived the exile or back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The people are in disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. And then Hananiah walks away. You don't hear from him again until chapters later. But this was Nehemiah's response. Nehemiah said, "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." You know much of this story. Nehemiah had a pretty audacious prayer. He said, "God, you put this on me, but there's no way I can do the task that you've asked me to do unless you give me favor to do it. So I'd like to ask you to do something, God, only you can do. When I'm in front of the king next time, I'm going to be sad," which could be the death sentence. "And if the king asks me, 'Why are you sad?' I'm going to ask him if he'll send me to Jerusalem to go rebuild the wall." Yeah, that's going to work. So the next time, months later, he's in front of the king looks at him and says, "You've never been sad in front of me before." And it literally says in the passage, Nehemiah hesitates and prays. You had one of those moments? You ask God for something, and then when he does it, you're like, "Oh, God, I'm in trouble." It says, Nehemiah stopped and he prayed, and he asked the king, "Would you send me to Jerusalem? Would you allow me to cut down part of the forest around it? Would you give me the authority to be able to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem?" The king's response was, "When are you coming back?" And sent him. Here's the interesting thing. When he gets there, he says this: "You see the trouble we're in? Jerusalem lies in ruins. Its gates have been burned with fire." And then he says to them, "Come, let us rebuild the wall. We will no longer be in disgrace. I told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me, and they replied, 'Let's rebuild.' And we began," as it says, "the good work." Now listen, the wall had been down around Jerusalem 150 years. They all started the work, and they rebuilt it in 52 days. 52 days it took them to rebuild what had been down in 150 years. Now remember, those folks had lived there for 150 years, generation after generation. In this town, the rubble, all the fallen stones were right there. It's not like the people that conquered Jerusalem carried the stones off. They pulled them down. They literally lived next door to the fallen down pieces for 150 years. And when they determined they were going to do it, they rebuilt it in 52 days. How did they do it? If you remember the story, Nehemiah said, "Every family, take the part of the wall that you live next to, that's your part." And literally took the whole city, pushed them to the edges, and said, "Everybody sees the rubble? Take the part right next to your house. We will rebuild." 52 days later, it's done. Why do I tell you that story? Well, let me set some context for you. As conservatives, I think we want to be more like Nehemiah than Hanani. Hanani saw the problem and walked away. Nehemiah saw the problem, prayed, and then went to work. Here's a sure test to figure out whether you're a Nehemiah person or a Hanani person. You ready for the test? Tell me about the dishes in your sink. Is the dishwasher clean or dirty, and are there dishes in the sink? Now, if you're a parent, you can know this test for sure. At my house, I've measured it. It's exactly 30 inches from the dishwasher to the sink. But so help me, dishes end up here rather than 30 inches away over there. Ann and I would look at the dishes and go, "Somebody else will take care of this." Nehemiah said, "There's a problem. I should fix it." So let me set some context for you in where we are. This is not an election year. Most of you are very passionately engaged in your precincts. Can I set aside election for a moment? And that's hard for all of us. And let's look at the context of where we are. What's God calling you to? What's your part of the wall? You don't have every part of the wall. You have your part. Where has he placed you? What has he called you to? And are you fulfilling specifically your part of the broken down wall of our nation? Because for a long time, we've looked around and said things are messed up. Somebody should come fix this. Maybe it's time each of us take a section of the wall and say, this part's mine. We've talked a lot about life, rightfully so. There are lots of things to be done. Steve, your comments on the life issues and so many others, and Joni, your comments on the life issues were very passionate and spot on. Joni and I, when we were working together on the Planned Parenthood piece, that we got passed. We're well known as a Senate for the things we didn't get passed. For some reason, we forget the things we did. When Joni and I did the CRA piece to strip away the Obama rule mandating every state uses Planned Parenthood, she and I stripped that away and led that from the Senate and got passed, and the president signed it, and it's done at this point, giving states flexibility again. The infant protection, born alive bills, the pain-capable bills, the heartbeat bills, there's so many issues that are out there that are undone or that are in process. But there are some things that are done and keep moving. We've got a great task to be able to do legislatively, but can I remind us again, it's all about what we do and how we're engaged locally. The most powerful part of what we're doing for life is not what's happening in Washington, D.C. It's what's happening in crisis pregnancy centers all over this state, my state, and around the country. It's volunteers looking face-to-face with abortion-minded women saying, let's talk about this. Would you consider having a sonogram? Would you consider looking at your child? And allowing abortion-minded woman to be able to look inside of her own womb and count fingers and toes and listen to the heartbeat and realize that she's been told a lie. People told her it's tissue, but when she looks on that screen, that doesn't look like tissue, that looks like a baby. And the whole world changes. The passion for life is coming from volunteers that are engaged in this in crisis pregnancy centers all over the country. It comes from practical conversations. We're on the right side of this issue. We don't have to be angry about it. The facts are on our side. I love getting on the floor and debating on this issue because I can just simply smile at people when they yell at me about women's rights and say, you know what? 50-50 shot, that's also a girl in the womb. Does she not have a right? When you look inside the womb and you count 10 fingers and 10 toes and see a beating heart and a functioning nervous system and DNA that is different than the mom's and different than the dad's, you realize that's not tissue. That's a child. And we do not value life based on how tall they are. We value life when it's life. We continue to love and encourage people and continue to walk through this process, but that is a community by community experience. You realize abortion did not become the rule of the land by congressional action. It was a court that imposed it on the nation. And decades later, there are still people saying, this is done. We shouldn't talk about it anymore. Then why is more than half of the nation still passionately pro-life, when supposedly it's a settled issue? They want us to be silent because they're losing this argument. We should love them, encourage them, and continue to speak out for those who cannot speak for themselves, and continue to say, let's count fingers and toes, and you tell me that's tissue. I'll tell you it's a child. That's something we do locally. There's a lot of economic work that has to be done. Quite frankly, on tax policy, it's one of the things that we actually need to get done this year, is a major tax reform bill. Tax reform is one of those things that people look at and they hold it up as a goal, and I try to smile at them and say, whoa, tax reform is not the goal. Economic activity is a goal. Tax reform is a toolbox in the tool of trying to get there. But let's get to the real goal. It's jobs being started again. It's people getting a chance to bring home more money and to be able to invest it how they choose to invest it rather than how the government chooses to invest it. It's a vehicle to be able to get our economy moving again. There are lots of ways to be able to do that, but certainly tax policy is one of them. I'd be straight up to tell you, one of the areas of tax policy that we need to deal with is the marriage penalty that still exists in our tax policy and in our welfare assistance programs. That needs to be resolved. One of the issues we've got to resolve is the Johnson Amendment. Now, I still run into so many people that say they have no idea what that is. Here's the simple principle of what it is. In the 1950s, LBJ, when he was a senator in Texas, was ticked off at a nonprofit that spoke out against him during his campaign for Senate. He was in a powerful position in the Senate, and he was able to slip in text that was never debated in the Senate. Not in committee, not on the floor, never debated. He slipped in text into the final part of a tax bill saying that nonprofits could not speak out on anything electioneering. Literally took a whole group of people and said, you lose your First Amendment rights of free speech when you work for a nonprofit. It's never been tested in the courts because it'll fail. And they know it. But the IRS uses it to hang over nonprofits and over churches and say, we will take away your nonprofit status if you speak out on anything that's electioneering. And many churches will just back up and say, well, I can't speak on these issues. Can I tell you, where Scripture speaks to those issues, don't you dare pull back. Stay engaged. This is just a simple principle of fairness. Our liberal friends want to talk about fairness? Let's talk about it. Here's basic fairness. Whether you work for a for-profit organization, you're unemployed, retirement, a teenager, or for a nonprofit, you have the same First Amendment rights as everyone else has. You cannot say to someone, you work for the wrong place, and so you can't speak. To accent that even more, what other constitutional right do you lose when you are at a nonprofit? Do you lose your Second Amendment rights? No. Do you lose your right to due process? No. Do you lose any other right? No. Only speech. They target that one right, the most effective thing that happens in pulpits across America and across nonprofits across America. Folks have said back to me, they've said, well, you know what? They're in a nonprofit. They get some sort of government benefit, so they should have a limitation on their speech because they get a government benefit. If they don't want to get a government benefit, then they can say whatever they want. So all they have to do is give up their nonprofit status. I've said, okay, that's fair enough. So everyone that gets a government benefit doesn't have freedom of speech. Yes. All right. Let's start with every person that gets a social service program. They all lose their freedom of speech, right? Every university that gets any sort of government grant, they should all lose their First Amendment rights. Every person that works for Planned Parenthood also gets a government benefit because they have government money coming up. So they should all lose their First Amendment rights. No, they shouldn't. They should have the First Amendment rights the same as everyone else does. And so should everyone else. Now, let me just give this one caveat. After 22 years of ministry, I would tell you, I do not believe every church should talk about politics. Politics are talked about everywhere, but there's only one place on earth that talks about the gospel every single week, week after week, and that's the church. And we should not get distracted. But I have a real problem when someone tells a pastor they can't say something from their pulpit. That's different whether they should or should not. Let's protect those basic rights. It's basic fairness. Our economics and the way that we do business and the way that we turn around things should turn around our economy and will, given the opportunity to be able to fully implement them. It's the same thing with regulations. I chair the Regulatory Affairs Committee in the Senate. Don't blame me, by the way, for all the regulations. They're not my fault. We call ourselves affectionately the nerdiest committee in Congress, because we deal with the process of how regulations are made. We're trying to do a simple thing. That is to be able to return the decision-making back to people. Regulations, when they're made, are supposed to be a product of legislation. And legislation requires input. By the way, so does regulation. We've been working on a small business regulation reform bill that's pretty standard. Here's what it says. Small businesses should be heard when regulations are made. That there should be no regulation that's put out there that they don't at least contact small businesses and say, how would this affect you? How would the cost affect you? And it would include this one thing. For small business owners, if the federal agency comes down and sees something wrong, they can't walk in and fine them the first time. They walk in and give them a warning the first time. How many of you got up this morning and read the Federal Register? Anyone? Bueller, anyone? Okay, no one got up and read the Federal Register today, but federal bureaucrats will say all small businesses know about regulations because we printed it in the Federal Register. And when there's a change, we'll update the Federal Register with new updates. Small businesses are just doing their life, taking care of their family and their employees. So when a federal person comes in, they shouldn't have the power to fine them the first time. They should just say, hey, here's something you might not have known about. That doesn't seem like much of a radical concept to just require small businesses to be heard when they do regulations and for small businesses to get a warning before they get a fine. But I have exactly zero Democrat co-sponsors on that bill. Zero. That's the challenge that we face in a culture. So what can we do locally and individually just to be able to raise up and do our part of the wall? I've got part of the wall that I'm going to take on. You've got part that you're going to take on life, on tax, on regulations. What's your part on tax and regulations? As odd as it sounds, I have lots of folks that say to me in Oklahoma and maybe even here tonight would say, do tax reform, do regulatory reform. And when I say back to them, what do you need reform? They're like, it. One of my favorite quotes to some of the folks that I visit with in Oklahoma all the time is, I can't fix regulations, but I can sure go after and fight a regulation. Tell me which one is the problem. Our part of the wall is identifying when you're fighting through the issues, making sure you get a clear answer and say, that one's the problem. Because I've yet to find anybody that's against everything. But we do know what's the problem. We've got parts of the wall that are down. We've got issues that in our nation that legislation's not going to fix. It's going to be our family taking it on. About a year and a half ago, after watching a group of police officers assassinated in Dallas, and after yet another shooting, I sat down with my staff and I said, this is not a legislative fix in culture and race in our country. This is something deeper. We prayed together. I know that's shocking. We prayed together. We talked about it. And a little while later, I came back to my staff after asking around a question. As odd as this sounds, I started asking people, everyone that I ran into, I asked them a simple question. Has your family ever invited a family of another race to your home for dinner? Consistently, no matter which race I asked, consistently the answer I got back was, I have friends of another race. And I would smile and say, that's not what I asked you. Has your family ever invited a family of another race to your home for dinner? So that your kids or grandkids are sitting at your dinner table with a family of another race and their kids or grandkids. Usually it was silence. And then I would say, I believe the race issues in America are not a legislative fix. They're a relational fix. You see, a national conversation on race is not some big table with cameras all around it and elected politicians talking around a table. That's not a national conversation on race. A national conversation on race is at dinner tables in our own homes. That's where national conversations happen. I've said this over and over again. We'll never get all the issues on the table about race until we get all of our feet under the same table and actually have a conversation. So my simple challenge is, if you want to take part of the wall in our culture of race in our country, do this simple thing. Your family, invite a family of a different race to your home for dinner. I pick Sundays because Sundays are a very significant day. But I call it Solution Sundays. You want to be part of the solution on race? Pick a time. With my African-American friends, I tell them I'm going to meet you for dinner. Because if I meet you for lunch, you don't get out of church until 2 o'clock, and I'll be hungry by then. So we'll meet for dinner that night. Find a time your family can invite another family over. And you may say, well, that's not a revolution. Do it. See what happens. Because I've had person after person after person text me with a picture of their Solution Sunday dinner and said, here's what we decided to do during dinner. I think you may be surprised. We as a nation are still being watched by the rest of the world. We lose track as Americans. The entire world does not deal with race like we do. Most of the rest of the world is still separated by race and tribe and religion. And you live over there, and you live over there, and they don't do it like us. And they're confused and astounded that we even try. When we finish the work on race that we've started, and we've come a long way on race, we're not talking about three-fifths of a man anymore or separate but equal. We've come a long way on race, but we are not done. But when we are done, we will continue to be the shining city on the hill to demonstrate to the rest of the world, this is a better way. Come follow us. But that's a part of the wall. That's not something that can happen from somewhere else. That's us taking our section of the wall and saying, what is our family going to do to be able to deal with the culture on race? It's a simple challenge that I put in front of people all the time, especially elected officials. There's so many great state elected officials that are here. I try to remind them, as conservatives, we believe in federalism. But the only way federalism works is when the state steps up and leads as well. It's one thing to say, those federal guys should get out of our business. It's another thing for state leaders to rise up like your state is doing and saying, we will take responsibility. Federal government, do your job. We will do ours. It's a basic principle where local leaders put local ideas out and dare a federal bureaucrat to tell them no, because they can do it a better way. It's where families and freedom really come together. When we take a section of the wall, I interact with so many people that talk about how much their next-door neighbor bugs them and about how crazy that family is. If, by the way, that's you and your family, don't point them out and don't name them. But I would tell you this. The reason government is getting so big is because families are collapsing. As families collapse, government rushes in to fill the gap. We have to do additional things for these children. We have to do additional things for these moms. We have to do additional things for job training. We have to do additional things for criminal justice. We have to do additional things for programs because the families are collapsing and government's trying to fill the gap, and we're watching this occur. We as conservatives want to jump on the stack of government and push it down. You want to know what the real solution is? Grab families and push them up. Because as families grow stronger and they do their task, when families are doing what only families can do, there's less need for government, and it's way easier to jump on that stack and go, let's start clearing this junk out, because families are taking care of this. Criminal justice is an issue because of collapsed families. Our education issues, over and over again, I talk to teachers, they'll always say they need more funding, always. And then right behind it, they'll say their biggest challenge they have in the school is parents that are disengaged. If only the parents were engaged, this would be different. It's collapsing families. We can do something about that. Senior adults, God has given you time and wisdom. As Scripture says, that gray hair is a crown for the aged. And it's also a gift to young couples that are thinking about marriage, or just barely married, or just starting to have kids. Please don't back up. Your nation needs you still. If you would mentor one family, one, if you would just take that crazy neighbor near you and mentor them and help them walk in faith, learn how to stay married, learn how to raise their kids, you would be an incredible gift. Let me take this harder. Studies have been done on victims of human trafficking When they come out of human trafficking, those girls don't trust other girls their age because they used to do horrible things with them. And they don't trust typically ladies their mom's age, but they do trust ladies their grandparents' age. Though that may terrify you, I would encourage you to pray Nehemiah's prayer. Some of those victims of human trafficking need grandmothers that would love them back to wholeness. You want to fix the wall? You want to fix what's broken in our culture? Take the part that's right in front of you. Because someone from Washington, D.C. is not going to turn that around. That's going to be local. That's going to be somebody face to face. We as conservatives don't believe that Washington, D.C. fixes everything. It's about time we put that into practice. And to say the problems that I see out my window are mine. What am I going to do about it? Nehemiah's challenge to them was, how do we turn this around? Now, I can assure you, we've got issues we've got to fix as a Senate. I promise. One of the things that I put out several months ago, in fact, started on it 2 years ago, was a proposal to fix the rules of the Senate. The rules of the Senate are severely broken. They're not just anachronistic and arcane. They're non-functional anymore. So I put out a basic set of proposals, beginning with the filibuster rule. Most people don't know that there's actually two filibusters for every single bill, every one of them. You have to have 60 votes to get on a bill. You have to have 60 votes to get off of it. And then you pass the bill with 51. Now, in the past, whoever was in the majority, always the minority gave them permission to get on whatever bill. That's now changed. The rule didn't change. The practice has changed. We need to change the rule to catch up to our practice. So I have proposed killing the filibuster at the beginning. The majority party should be able to debate whatever we want to debate. When Chuck and Joni and I wanted to debate defunding Planned Parenthood, we could literally not get on the standalone bill because the Democrats would not allow us to start debate on it. That is absurd. I propose a simple shift in nominations. President Trump has faced something no president in American history has faced. That is a minority party that's using all of its tactics to delay his staff being hired. Do you realize the current tactics being used by the Democrats in the Senate, it will take President Trump 11 years to get his staff. 11 years. Yes, that's correct. He can only serve 8. But it'll take 11 years for him to get his staff in place with the way they're slowing it. They can't stop any of them. And everybody says, I thought the filibuster rule cleared that out and you can pass any nominee with 51. You can, but they can run the clock for 30 hours on every single person before you ever get to the vote of 51. 11 years. Here's a simple rule change that I proposed. Allow only 2 hours of debate for a lower nominee, 4 hours of debate for a mid-level, and 8 hours for cabinet officials. Does anyone think that's radical? It's already determined by the time they get there. The cabinet folks have already gone through the process. They've already been in committees. They've already been approved. There's no grand shock here. Everybody knows what the outcome's going to be. It's just delay tactics to delay it. So we've laid out this simple idea. Change the way that we actually do the nomination process. Be able to shift that over. And I've also added this one crazy idea. It's possible, if the Senate wanted to, we could actually legislatively walk and chew gum at the same time. I know this is radical. But maybe we could do nominations in the morning and legislation in the afternoon. Wow. I know that's crazy. But that is actually not permitted in the Senate right now unless you have unanimous consent to do that. All 100 people have to agree just to do that simple thing. Otherwise, you do one thing at a time. Simple. It's called dual tracking. That we can have two different calendars running on the same day, nominations calendar, legislative calendar, and actually debate things at different parts of the day. The Senate structure was created in a time when senators had no staff at all. I can assure you, there's plenty of staff walking the hallways now. We can monitor two things happening at once. Those are rule changes that we have got to do in the Senate to be able to fix the process. My question for you is, that's my job. That's my part of the wall. What are the structural changes you and your family need to make to impact your part of the wall? Maybe it's your time commitments. Maybe it's your volunteer time. Maybe it's what you're doing. Maybe it's focusing on that neighbor. But I'd encourage you to do a really radical thing. Do what Nehemiah did. Pray and ask God, what's your job? And see what he whispers back to you. You want to take a risk? Do that. And then find a broken part of the wall and get started. I would call on us as conservatives to pray more than we complain and to engage in the difficult issues that still need to be done. Because the issues of religious liberty that most certainly need to be done legislatively, and I've done a lot to be able to push back nationally on issues of religious liberty, but religious liberty boils down to this simple principle: people of faith living their faith. It's the greatest testimony that we have for why faith needs to be protected. It was one of my favorite interviews on one of those famous tornadoes I told you about, when an NBC News reporter showed up in Oklahoma City the day after a tornado and in their interviews made the comment, before FEMA got here, Faith FEMA was already on the ground. We believe, as conservatives, we take on our issues first. We don't wait for someone else from somewhere else to come fix what is uniquely ours. My call to you in a non-election year is, what's your part? What is God calling you to do? And are you taking it on? Because there is much to be done. And God has called us to do it. God bless y'all. Look forward to seeing how we fix the wall together.